This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. There you are, stuck in an aluminum tube 37,000 feet in the air with only your cell phone for company. The business end of national security on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosdahl. Tuesday, March the 21st. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Sometimes the business news of the day is a political story. Sometimes it's an economic indicator story. Sometimes, like today, it masquerades as a national security story. This morning, the White House gave airlines that fly direct to U.S. airports from 8 Middle Eastern and North African countries 96 hours to figure out a way to get all electronic devices bigger than a cell phone out of the passenger cabin and into passengers' checked bags. It'll affect about 50 flights, news that will be unwelcome to business travelers and the airlines that are used to having their business. Marketplace's Rima Kreis gets us going.
Twice a month, Danny Seabright travels from D.C. to the United Arab Emirates for business.
And I immediately first thought was, well, how am I going to fly back and forth to do my business in the UAE and not be able to use my laptop on the 14-hour flight each way?
As the president of the U.S.-UAE Business Council, Seabright typically spends those hours in the air writing memos and sending emails. From now on, his thumbs will be doing all the work on his iPhone. The restrictions could cost airlines like Qatar and Emirates some of their best travelers, says George Hopica, founder of AirfareWatchdog.com.
The business traveler is the cash cow for these airlines.
He says many devices hold sensitive information, and airlines don't typically cover damages.
If I were a business traveler, I would not allow my laptop to be put in the cargo hold. Absolutely not.
Hobica thinks many travelers from the countries included in the ban will change their routes to connect in Europe.
I'm sure that the CEOs of Delta, United, and American are jumping in the aisles right now.
For years, U.S. carriers have complained loudly about the subsidies Middle Eastern competitors get from their governments. Samuel Engel runs the aviation group at the consulting firm ICF. He says over the last decade, long-haul routes from the Middle East to the U.S. have increased dramatically.
What they've really been affecting is the traffic that previously used to connect over Europe and also the traffic going between the U.S. and other points in Asia.
Engel says the device ban could potentially tip the competitive balance. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
The squeeze is on for the GOP health care plan. President Trump went to Capitol Hill today to do a little politicking ahead of the vote that's expected Thursday night. The big hurdle, aside from the Democrats staying completely on the sidelines, is within the Republican caucus itself. House leaders are real eager to get conservatives on board with this bill. So last night they made some changes. One sweetener would let states add work requirements to Medicaid eligibility rules, should they so choose. From the health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein explains how that might work.
Here's the basic concept behind the idea of work requirements.
To help people so they can be independent.
That's Ron Haskins, a senior advisor to George W. Bush on welfare.
People who are on Medicaid have to try to get off welfare. They have to try to work.
Haskins, echoing many conservatives, believes Medicaid or any kind of government assistance should be a temporary stop. enter this amendment, giving states the option to require so-called able-bodied adults to either work, look for work, or go to school. That's around 24 million people, a third of everyone on Medicaid. Many Republicans believe Obamacare broke the dam, letting healthy adults flood onto the program. Judy Solomon is at the left-leaning Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
There's no proof that there's a lot of people in that situation.
The Kaiser Family Foundation found 59% of those adults do work. Many at home say they're there due to illness, disability, or taking care of a family member. Harvard health policy professor Kathy Schwartz says pushing those people into work won't work.
I think it also will cause people to decide that they simply should not sign up for Medicaid because they think they will not be eligible for it.
And if that happens, that likely means two things. People will be sicker, and the rest of us will likely save money because the Medicaid program will, over time, shrink. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Wall Street today? Yeah, you don't want to know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Seeing as how its future is in some doubt, President Trump had at it again at his rally last night. We're doing a series this week about NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. We had a candid discussion yesterday about your pants and my pants. Also, a chat with Mexico's NAFTA negotiator, Jaime Serra. Today, the other two people who were at the table with Dr. Serra, Ambassador Carla Hills, she was the U.S. Trade Representative for President George H.W. Bush, and Michael Wilson, Canada's Minister of Finance at the time and later Ambassador to the United States. Welcome to the program to you both.
Oh, good to be with you.
It's a great pleasure.
Ma'am, if I could ask you first, give us the global economic snapshot when you were asked to negotiate NAFTA, would you?
I talked to Jaime Serra, who was the trade minister in Mexico, and he was very interested in moving forward with a bilateral with the United States. I came home and talked to the president. We decided to go forward and got fast track or trade promotion authority from our Congress, and I was about to sit down with Mexico when I got a call from the then trade minister of Canada, who said, Carla, you're leaving me out. I said, your government almost crashed over our negotiation of the U.S.-Canada agreement. I can't imagine you want to be at the table. He said, well, I do.
Well, so Ambassador Wilson, let me ask you to climb in here, sir, and give me your perspective on what was going on.
Well, not much different than Carla, but what we did not want to have is a hub-and-spoke thing. We had already got our trade agreement with the United States 5 years before, and therefore we had a direct agreement, and we thought if Mexico has a direct agreement and we don't have a direct agreement with Mexico, the United States is going to be in a position where they have all the advantages, but we only have two-thirds of the advantages.
After all the negotiations and after all was said and done, as you look back on it, did NAFTA turn out the way you thought you were gonna?
I think NAFTA turned out very, very well. We eliminated all industrial tariffs, opened up the services market, protected intellectual property, and between Mexico and the United States opened up agriculture. We also had a good settlement or dispute settlement mechanism. And so, yes, it was a premier trade agreement for its time.
Ooh, key caveat there, Ambassador, for its time. What does that mean?
That means that in the last 23 years that the economy has moved to automation and that there are things we could build upon that platform. It isn't that the agreement is bad. It is good and is a strong platform, and the three of us should work together. And there are a number of issues we could deal with that would continue to make North America the most competitive region in the entire world.
Ambassador Wilson, Ambassador Hills used the phrase the best agreement for its time. As you know, the current occupant of the White House calls it the worst deal that he's ever seen. Do you take seriously his threats to dismantle it?
Well, I do take seriously those threats because a lot of the things that he has said in the campaign, he has turned out to actually do a number of them. So, yes, we do take them seriously. But what I think we've been doing from the Canadian side, and I'm sure Mexico has been doing the same thing, we have been pointing out the importance of that relationship. 35 states in the United States have as their number one export market Canada. 9 million jobs in the United States are dependent on that trade relationship. And to disrupt that flow would be very, very important in a negative sense to both the United States and Canada.
Ambassador Hills, what happens, though, if the president goes ahead and either abrogates the treaty or changes it substantially?
Well, we would lose the advantages of our first largest export destination with Canada and our second largest export destination with Mexico. With Canada, we have a fallback of the U.S.-Canada agreement. With Mexico, we do not. We would rely upon the World Trade Organization agreement. Tariffs would go up, and so it would hurt the U.S. manufacturers, because about 60% of imports into the United States are intermediate goods. That's what makes our exports competitive, is that we can get the best goods to make our exports work. So it would be a disadvantage to the United States, and we would lose jobs.
Ambassador Wilson, do Canadians think and talk about NAFTA as much as Americans seem to?
We do in a positive way. I would say that the general feeling with both people in the manufacturing world as well as others have a positive sense on NAFTA. I think that there's another point that should be made here. There's a lot of talk about jobs lost through NAFTA because of these terrible trade agreements. What is clearly the cause of the lost jobs is technological change. And we've got to change the focus onto the changes in technology and do the things that will help mitigate the impact of that on individuals. But also, and the United States is in a terrific position to do this, take advantage of that technological change, because so much of it is driven out of your country.
But Ambassador Hills, as you know, automation is not a great selling point. Lousy trade deals and people stealing American jobs is a great political selling point.
You are correct. And that's why we have to get out to the American people what's involved in our agreement with our northern and southern neighbors that have made us competitive. And we also need, in addition to education, is to help those that have been dislodged from their job. It doesn't make any difference to them that it's automation or whether it is trade. And Michael Wilson is absolutely correct. The overwhelming majority, here we say about 93% of jobs lost due to changes in tastes and automation technology. But we need programs that are stronger, that train people for the 4 million jobs that we have looking for skilled workers. You don't need a doctorate or a college degree. You need 16 or 14 weeks of training. Hmm. And that's what we should be working at.
Ambassador Michael Wilson, the Canadian negotiator on the NAFTA Treaty, and Ambassador Carla Hills, the same for the United States. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Kai.
A pleasure to join you.
One more thing you got to hear, sort of along the lines of personal chemistry matters when stakes are high. Talking to these two today and Jaime Serra yesterday, I got the sense that they all got along pretty well, which makes this story about the three of them going to a baseball game to take a break from negotiations kind of great, honestly.
We did go to that baseball game, and then we broke up about halfway through the game. I think it was around the fifth inning. Jaime Serra wanted to go back to the negotiating table. He couldn't sit still. As we were walking out of the ballpark, there's a huge roar which I found out the next day was a triple play. And it would have been the only triple play that I would have seen in my life. And I always remind Jaime of that and criticize him deeply for disrupting the game just for a bloody trade negotiation.
He tells this story on himself, too. That's a good one. I like that.
Yeah, there's no question about that. Jaime was a soccer player. He didn't care about baseball. Michael cared about baseball a whole lot. But it's a good story. And it did happen.
Great, right? We got a video for you, a timeline of how NAFTA came to be with Ronald Reagan in a starring role. It's at marketplace.org. Coming up.
A lot of people describe it as the world's most important number and assumed that it was a reliable number.
You know what happens when you assume, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. There they are. It's been a while, huh? For the Wawas, take your pick. Healthcare delays, further policy uncertainty, I don't know. But the Dow Industrials has had enough. Off 237 points, 1.1% on the blue chips, ended at 20,668. The NASDAQ off 107 points, about 1.8%, 5793. The S&P 500 down 29 points, 1.25%, 2344 there. Financial stocks faltered today. Bank of America down 5.8%. Wells Fargo down 3%. JP Morgan Chase off 2.9%. Retailers felt the pressure as well. Macy's weakened 3.25%. JCPenney dipped 3.75%. Bond prices rose. All that money coming out of stocks had to go someplace. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.41%. You're listening to Marketplace. If you want to get smarter about all the things we talk about on this program every single day,
technology, the economy, pop culture, politics, check out our podcast, Make Me Smart.
Molly Wood is my co-host.
Or maybe Kai Rizdahl is my co-host.
I don't know. Maybe. We've got new episodes every week.
And we have live Facebook videos and all kinds of other great stuff for you.
Find us at marketplace.org/makemesmart or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts.
And please follow us on Twitter for more. I am at Molly Wood.
And I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Check it out. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. NAFTA is our economic theme this week, what it delivered and what it didn't. The thing with economics, though, is that sometimes you get the results you expect, and sometimes the law of unintended consequences comes into play. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has this story of NAFTA, immigration, and corn.
It was October 1993, and Janet Reno, the U.S. Attorney General, was giving a speech at UC San Diego, just 20 miles from the Mexican border.
I'd like to talk with you candidly about illegal immigration.
She was touting the benefits of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, which hadn't been ratified yet. And Reno said the trade deal would result in fewer Mexican people crossing the border to work illegally in the U.S. Workers in Mexico at the time were taking home just 30% of what U.S. workers earned on average each year. But NAFTA, Reno said, would make the Mexican economy so much better.
NAFTA is our best hope for reducing illegal immigration in the long haul.
That's what a congressional commission found, and Reno believed it. Mexico's president even said NAFTA would help his country export goods, not people. But it turns out the policy wonks got it wrong. They didn't count on stories like this.
I was born in 1994. For Mexico, it was a very monumental year. It was the year that NAFTA took place.
This is Elaine. It's her middle name. These days, she's afraid of being deported. Her mom's family grew corn in Mexico back when NAFTA was signed.
My family is from Morelos, Mexico. Morelos, it's like a lot of parts in Mexico, very agriculture-based.
NAFTA opened up Mexico as a market for U.S. farm products. They poured in, including tons of cheap U.S. corn.
Like, it was more expensive to grow our own corn than to buy it from the U.S.
U.S. corn farmers had their crop prices protected by the U.S. government. That's on top of other advantages. Good soil, ample rainfall, and new genetically modified seeds, which boosted yields. A corn farmer named Bruce Peterson is driving me around southern Minnesota. We stop at a rail line that hauls corn out of the Midwest to other markets, including Mexico.
So it would follow this track here down quite a long ways to Mexico if it came from here.
Well, possibly, yep.
U.S. producers export about $2 billion a year in corn to Mexico.
Mexico is our number one purchaser of corn.
It's yellow corn, largely for animal feed, not for tortillas. The farmers in Mexico couldn't compete against the Midwestern corn giants. Many downsized or folded. In Elaine's family, her mom left the farm for the U.S. She got to America and found a job in fast food.
And so her plan was to just send money back to Mexico so that my grandma could raise me.
But her mom missed her. She sent for Elaine to join her.
My grandma and I crossed the border. Like, we actually went through the desert.
On foot. She was just 3 years old. Like many experts, economist Tim Kehoe at the University of Minnesota thought NAFTA would supercharge Mexico's economy, so any workers hurt, like corn farmers, would certainly find new jobs. But in the two decades following NAFTA, Mexico's per capita GDP only grew at an annual rate of 1.3%, and Mexico's poverty levels haven't budged much.
When we look at it, that growth miracle did not occur.
Other countries in Latin America, like Brazil, Chile, and Peru, have actually seen better economic growth than Mexico, with no NAFTA. And when people in Mexico didn't find new opportunities at home, many headed for the U.S. Now, not all economists agree that sluggish growth in Mexico sent more people across the border. But Kehoe says in the case of the corn farmers, NAFTA actually accelerated their rate of illegal immigration. Stephen Camarada with the Conservative Center for Immigration Studies says it's even more complicated because NAFTA did create new jobs in Mexico. Many factories sprung up along the border.
So many people came north to get those jobs, and that did improve their standard of living somewhat and did increase their salaries. But once you've left home and come right to the border for a somewhat better life, why not then cross the border and quadruple your wages by working in the United States, say? And that also seems to have happened.
Experts got a lot wrong about NAFTA back in the 90s, and Camarada says it's hard to guess what will happen with immigration if we renegotiate the deal. In St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
There are some finance and economic terms that are, for want of a better phrase, the usual suspects. GDP, the jobless rate, CPI, inflation. They're pretty familiar. Less well known, but arguably more important, is what's called LIBOR, the London Interbank Offered Rate, an interest rate on which trillions of dollars hang every day, and which was, sort of smack in the middle of the financial crisis, fudged, rigged, one might say, to make some bankers and traders a boatload, several boatloads, really, of money. LIBOR is at the heart of a new book by Wall Street Journal editor David Enrich. It's called The Spider Network. David, thanks for coming on the program.
Good to be here.
I think maybe first things first is a little make me care paragraph here. If I have a credit card or a car loan or a mortgage, why do I need to know about LIBOR?
Because how much money you're paying each month depends in large part on LIBOR. This is an interest rate that is responsible for basically all other interest rates in the world. It's a lot of people describe it as the world's most important number and assumed that it was a reliable number. It's basically an arbitrary figure pulled out of thin air by a bunch of low-level functionaries at banks. There's not, at least historically, there is very little thought or effort that was put into setting this number in a precise, realistic way.
Okay, so with that as background, tell me now about the protagonist of this book, Tom Hayes, and why and what he did with LIBOR.
Well, protagonist, I would maybe quibble a little bit with that word.
Sure.
Because protagonist makes it sound like he's a good guy. And what he is he's a complicated guy. He's a mildly autistic British mathematician who was in his early 30s when he came of age in the banking industry. And he was someone who was very good with numbers, not very good with humans or social cues. He recognized a way that he and his colleagues and competitors could nudge LIBOR up or down by very small amounts every day to make a lot of money for themselves based on these complicated instruments called derivatives that they trafficked in, which for a long time made him the toast of the industry. I mean, everyone was trying to hire him. Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, JP Morgan, everyone wanted this guy because he was so good at pushing the envelope.
Yeah. So, I mean, not to spoil the book, but Tom Hayes does wind up in jail.
you wind up corresponding with him. You get extraordinary access to him and his emails and his texts and all kinds of things. And you actually say this in the acknowledgement section of the book. I don't quite understand why he cooperated with me.
I was working on a profile of him back in 2013, and one day my phone rang in the evening, and it was Tom Hayes, who was, I think, really desperate to find someone who would listen to him. But I watched him go from this kind of arrogant, very cocksure trader to sinking into the suicidal depression and making a series of gambles with his legal strategy and with the prosecutors that basically ruined his life and ruined his family's life. And it was really instructive for me as a financial journalist to, you know, everyone goes around banging the drum for more bankers to go to jail. And then I finally get to know a banker who's about to go to jail. And I, of course, develop some sympathy for him.
Now that all is said and done, Tom Hayes is in jail. People have lost jobs, all of that. What of LIBOR itself? Is it now more controlled and disciplined?
Yeah, it is. There's been so much regulatory tension on this in the past. The next financial scandal is very unlikely to involve LIBOR. And that's the interesting thing right now, I think, is that the pendulum swung very hard in the pro-regulation direction after the financial crisis. Mm-hmm. It seemed that people had really learned the lesson. And now in the early days of the Trump administration, we're seeing that pendulum swinging just in the absolute polar opposite direction very quickly.
It's a book by David Enrich about the LIBOR manipulation scandal that's called The Spider Network. David, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Final note on the way out today, which comes with this caveat: markets go up and markets go down. More than once since Election Day, first president-elect and then President Trump and his aides have claimed credit for the stock market's gains. So I think the Code of Business Journalism Ethics pretty much obliges me to play this tape of Press Secretary Sean Spicer today in response to a question from Eamon Javers from CNBC, which basically went, how do you like the markets now?
Well, I think to look at any one day is nothing that we've always cautioned.
That actually hasn't been the case. There has been no caution. But yeah, no, don't look at just one day because the markets go up and the markets go down. To recap, as we end for the day, the Dow off 237 points, 1.1%. NASDAQ off 107, that's 1.8%. S&P 500 down 29 points, about 1.25%. Tommy Andres and Raghu Madhavan are the producers on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.